So welcome in the fresh new year 2016. So last time, I apologize, I was not here. I was at a meeting in Lyngby, close to Copenhagen, where Flemming Nielsen and his wife, Hanne Ries Nielsen, celebrated kind of their 60th birthday, and there was a scientific colloquium where I presented some kind of work, and so I have been there. But Stefan, I guess, made it nicely presented to you the final issues concerning register allocation. So that was about SSA, and that for, interestingly, if you have a program in SSA format, that then register allocation becomes quite surprisingly similar to register allocation for interval graphs, because one, instead of intervals on a line, we had intervals in trees. So there were these tree segments which turned out to have similar properties as intervals on a line. And so one could kind of, by a very natural DFS kind of greedy algorithm, do the register allocation. So that was, at least I found it surprising to a certain point. So now let's turn to other hardware resources which we would like to exploit for better speed. And so registers is one prominent example, which is well known, well studied, with clean solutions. It's much more difficult and less obvious what one should do with all kinds of parallelism provided by hardware. And the reasons for that is manifold, and the most important reason is that the variety of ideas how to provide parallelism on chip is huge. So there are many ideas what you could do, and it's not so, and many ideas seem to be a little bit ad hoc, and it's not so clear how one can, without targeting a very specific hardware architecture, how to address them in a way that you can kind of get general principles. So, but still, let's try to do that. And so let's, so now it's about parallelism on a chip. So here we kind of speak about instruction level parallelism. So there could be other parallelisms. There could be parallelism by providing multi-cores. And so providing multi-cores is in some sense, to a certain extent, at least if there are not so many cores, then the best idea to exploit multiple cores is not on the programming level, language level, but on the operating systems level. Because typically your computer is running multiple tasks. So you have a browser open, and you read email and edit something and run your compiler. And so it's in that sense, it's convenient to distribute different user tasks on different cores. And by that, these different user tasks are kind of become independent, and each one is served optimally. So that's kind of the best, in some sense, the most easiest way. That works, I guess, if you have, if really your computer is used heavily, so that you have not just one application open, but it fails. It clearly will not do the job if you have not just 2, 3, 4 cores, but you have 64, 128, and whatnot. How many cores? Yeah, if you have really many cores, then one would have to think about making use of these also on the compiler's level, because otherwise all that hardware would be not used. But here, so here for the moment we concentrate on that instruction level. Parallelism, that is something which we would like to exploit for a single application. And so there are, on the instruction level things, there is already a huge variety that is now, because so here I kind of may refer to two versions which perhaps come even in a combined setting, which are sometimes even typically combined, and you could have one third one also which has been quite popular for a while, and that is this: if you have out of order execution, so that is you have the runtime system of the processor loads in a kind of a list of instructions which it assumes that they all have to be executed, and then by hardware determines the dependencies between these, and then executes as much of these instructions in parallel as possible. So that is so. In that sense, the parallelization is done not statically but dynamically at runtime. So this has a certain potential if the code is organized well. So if there is a potential for concurrency, but there's not so much to do how you can influence it at compile time, because it's done at runtime by the processor and it's like a black box. So here we therefore concentrate on things which we might influence better. And this is this FLIF and VLIW and this pipelining. Now what is that? So so VLIW, this means that you do not execute one instruction at a time but multiple instructions, and that these multiple instructions are combined in longer words, and so that you can do more than one thing at a time. And so here, that is, in this sense, the compiler has to statically parallelize in order to fill the slots in the words. And now the question is, how many slots would there be? And the more slots, the more the higher is the expectation on the smartness of the compiler, and the more difficult it is to fill them. So realistic, probably, I think there are even more longer things, but four maybe is something which is perhaps doable by a compiler easily. Not easily, but at least somehow. Okay, so that is one thing. So for that you multiply your ALU and your other execution units, and then you could kind of do that. And then the other thing is pipelining. So I guess you all of you know about or have heard about pipelining. This is more, I would say this is more or less standard now. This is standard in all processors nowadays. And the idea is that you kind of do not consider separate execution of instructions into stages, and then you overlap the stages. And by that you can make better use, even without multiplying your hardware, as you would do for VLIW. You would be able to make better utilization of your available hardware, in that because otherwise, once an instruction has left stage one, then stage one falls silent and does nothing until the next instruction arrives. So, but if the instruction arrives immediately, so then you can the stage one can operate continuously, and so the next stage, and so on. So, in that sense, this pipelining is a very good idea to make better use of your of your hardware. Now let's see. So here down there I have an example of such how an idealized VLI W instruction would look like. It looks like the assignments or so, or the operations which we had in our little intermediate language, but only now you have multiple of them. So here these are, for example, three, and you immediately notice what kind of problems there might arise. Namely, the question is it possible to read and write the same register in the same instruction, or is that simply ruled out? So what would one do in that situation? So if you think of such kind of either parallelization by VLIW or by pipelining, then one still has to take into account that every instruction, whenever, well, that is perhaps a trivial statement, every instruction requires certain hardware resources, and at different stages of its execution may be different hardware resources, but still there is some. And that must be, if I want to combine instructions, execute them at the same time, so then I better take care that they occupy different hardware resources. And also if I overlap, I can overlap only as much as there are no shared resources occupied. And so what are shared resources? Clearly, there could be registers, but there could be also that certain hardware facilities are not multiplied. For example, there might not be, so there could be, it could be that you have multiple floating point units, but it could be that you only have one. And then if you have two, then you cannot combine two floating point operations into one very long instruction word. Or think about buses. Typically, the number of buses is not multiplied arbitrarily, and that means if one instruction accesses the bus, then it might perhaps not be possible to execute at the same time another instruction which also occupies the bus. So if a bus is, or so when a bus is used, so that might, they might be occupied if you access the cache. That means if you have a memory access. And that means in this sense, if you have, that means at the same time you cannot schedule two instructions which do a memory access. So you could schedule them one after the other, but you could not kind of at the very same time. So that is, in that sense, every shared resource, hardware resource, kind of constitutes something which you, which is a restriction to possible schedule, to the possible schedules which you can put onto your instruction execution. And instructions which kind of are in conflict with respect to such things, that is called a hazard, a hardware hazard. And also that is one thing. And then the other thing is, then so that is the first trivial observation was that what we started out is that instructions occupy resources. And the second equally trivial observation is that instruction execution takes time. So that means when an instruction returns a result, then that is sometimes later than it accesses its arguments. And so that means, for example, if these are really executed at precisely the same clock cycle, then the value which is read here still is, so it could be perfectly fine, this kind of scheduling, because the value read here is the value before the instruction, and that is this value written there is written only a few cycles later. So that in that sense, it's perfectly fine. Yeah. So now, so that is the thing with the time, which must be taken into account. And then the key observation, as I already have mentioned, and now I have tried to make here a little bit more concrete, is that the hardware which is occupied is not fixed during all execution time, but varies during execution time. One could kind of think of that the execution of an instruction goes through, as I called it, stages, and at different stages may occupy different hardware. So a typical sequence of stages would be that this one, but I would not claim that every hardware follows exactly that these are the only stages, and there could be not just one pipeline but multiple pipelines. So, for example, it could happen that execution itself is staged. So, for example, floating point operations typically are have their own, or not typically, they may have, they take some time and they may have their own pipelines. So that is, execution means that you put something into the pipeline for the floating point addition or multiplier, and then after some time this pipeline is kind of executed and then drops out the results, so they arrive sometime later and then kind of have to be fed back into the write back pipeline, for example. Yeah, so in that sense it's not so that this is kind of not cast into iron or something, so that is you could kind of see that more or less as an idea what is at least there. So let me just comment on that, what the stages which I listed here. So the first thing is to fetch the instruction is a non-trivial operation which takes some time. So why is this so? Well, because it is, you need an address, you have to go to memory, you have to take to look up what is there, you have to put it into your instruction register. So this is this may be extremely expensive if the value to be fetched is not in cash. So if it's in cash, you have it very quickly. But if it's not in cash, then it takes a lot of time. So that is for that reason. They have kind of instruction caches, where the instructions fetched at the last time. So they are so that you get rapid access to these. And the other thing is that you kind of have to do the addressing, so that means you have to you need to know which memory cell to fetch, and that might be only at the end of. So if you have a kind of an indirect jump, then the address from which to fetch the instruction may only become known to the processor at the very end of the execution of the preceding instruction. So this is clearly a problem. So then you cannot overlay. So this causes the pipeline to stall. Besides, you do something like optimistic fetching. You fetch something which you kind of hope that it is the next instruction to be executed, because, for example, it was the last time when I executed that instruction, it was this one which was the next one. So that could be the reason, or because you simply take the next instruction because you hope that in most of the cases you always take the next instruction. So by that you kind of optimistically may fetch something, but that means that you kind of start to execute an instruction although you are not yet sure whether this is the right instruction. So that means at some time maybe you have to roll back your evaluation and then do the right fetch and do the right execution and so on. But that again, you might hope that this rollback will happen not so often, and in most cases there's no rollback, and then you kind of, then there is, by that you may avoid some of these pipeline stalls. But this kind of indicates to you that this is the maintenance of a pipeline is a tricky business, and the hardware to do that and all that must not a kind of a program which you write in software, but it's kind of printed on the chip, so that is printed in hardware. So this is a complicated business to get the pipeline logic right. And I guess they have invested a lot of energy and expertise to get that kind of thing right. So, but in that sense, we use it, and the processor does what it does. But if you think of it in detail, one might find it admiring what they do there. So it's not so trivial, I would say. Okay. Yeah. So now from a compiler's perspective, so we want to kind of have instructions, produce instructions of that kind of go nicely, which kind of behave well with respect to the execution. That is, we would like to make it in such a way that the pipeline has not so many stalls, and also that the very long instruction words are, so we might want to fill them at compile time. So that might be our goal. And now here in some sense, so if you think of it, then filling the task of filling the pipeline nicely and is not so much different from constructing these very long instruction words, because let's go back. If you overlay two instructions, then you also better should kind of make sure that when you execute the next instruction, and so if it depends on data of the instruction which is just immediately before, then this might be problematic, because it has not yet been written. If it has not yet been written, you cannot safely execute the next instruction. So if there are data dependencies between instructions, you should put them something in between, so that the pipeline has time to execute the to compute the data which the succeeding successor instruction may consume. So in that sense, these constraints which we between reading and writing, which one might have in the similar constraints as one might have in for constructing long instruction words, might also apply to instructions put in sequence for good pipeline behavior. So now, in the following, we'll try to see how it might be possible to fill multiple slots in a very long instruction word. So this is kind of one instance of a problem which we might want to look at, and there we also kind of take into account how long it takes for an instruction to execute. And so that means if it takes longer, so we assume that every tick a long instruction word is the execution of a long instruction word might start, but the computation triggered by the execution of a long instruction word might not be finished in one step, but may take longer. And so that means by that we kind of have will not be able to schedule one very long instruction word immediately after the other, but maybe have to insert knob operations in order to make sure that sufficiently much time elapses before, so that the the correct results are already there. Yeah. So, so in order to kind of, so in that sense, we kind of consider both a little bit this, both to a certain extent. One thing is this pipelining, and on the other hand, this the VLIW slot filling problem at the same time. So, and now clearly it's a little bit artificial and much simplified from the real world. So let us, so we just consider plausible but not necessarily always available constraints which are not always like that, but they could be like that. So that is, so the constraints for filling the slots in our long words would be such that we allow only one load or store per word, due to the idea that probably that perhaps there is that there are not sufficiently many that there are not multiple buses which could be used by at the same time, and then clearly within one word you should have only one jump. Because otherwise you would jump in two locations. This does not really make sense. So there is only one jump. And also there could be, if we write, then the writing, there should be at most one write to a register and not multiple writes to the same register, which is kind of, yeah. So, and then we would consider time example timings of the different operations which might be in this long instruction word. So, for example, we would say floating point operation takes 3, loading and storing 2 cycles, and integer arithmetic, that is 1 cycle. So this is just an example timing. And clearly you see here this load and store, this assumes that the loading and the storing is within the cache. And if it's not in the cache, then the hardware would kind of do some kind of, I don't know, trap or something, interrupt and kind of loading there, and then regular operation continues. And the hope is that clearly these execution, these interrupts would happen not so often, and that means for all practical purposes, and in particular for code generation, we could assume that this loading and storing is quickly, as if it were to stack to the cache alone. Yeah. Okay. So then now let us go back to our little super duper instruction here. This one. So we have 3 slots. We have 3 operations. So this is assumed to be an integer plus. This perhaps this D, maybe a floating point register, D1 and D2 like the same, and this multiply there is a floating point multiply. And so this is a load. So that would kind of take one cycle, this would take 3, and this would take 2. So here the value, so here I have kind of perhaps so written values which are at certain time points in the registers, and this is the state of the register at tick 0, and then after 1 tick the integer addition has succeeded, and it was addition of R2 and R3, and that is put into register 1. And you see here it is, so you could think of that the value of R3 is read at tick 0, and it could, if it is overwritten at tick 2, then that would not be after tick 2, then this would not influence the correctness of the integer addition because R3 was read much earlier. Yeah. So this would be, in this sense, this would be fine. And here this floating point operation only would arrive after tick 3. Yeah, so it's the question is, for example, one might wonder how long this value here must be present before it can be overwritten. One could think of it. Yeah. So here is so whether it could already be overwritten after tick one. It could be possible, so maybe. So it depends on the hardware, or whether there should be kind of a certain hold time, how long this value is there. But I guess for us, we might simply assume that the writing of one into register R3 happens at the end of the of tick one. And the reading is at the beginning of this, so at the end of tick zero. So in that sense, in principle, if you have multiple reads and multiple writes, you need you have to fix rules. Or you have to fix the properties of the hardware, what is allowed, what is not allowed, what values will be returned if you read a value. Will you get the value of the register in the last tick, or will you get the value of the register in the present, which is written in the present tick, or what value will you get? And so one would have several kind of such conflicts, which one has somehow to resolve, or the hardware has to resolve, and the compiler has to know in order to take care of that. And so there are multiple conflict resolution ideas which could make sense. So for example, you could one could make no assumption on the how the hardware behaves, and that means that you simply cannot schedule two instructions into the same slot which access the same resource. And the other thing is, you could kind of assume that multiple reads are possible because they do not change the register, and so you simply get it. So that, but that is kind of a question whether the reading from a register, whether that is kind of the value of a register is kind of generally available, or whether you need some kind of particular data path to access the register. And if you use this data path from one direction, you cannot use it from another direction. So this depends on what really the hardware has realizes accesses to registers. But in general, reading multiple things should not be problematic. And now if you have a simultaneous read and write, then then we had currently the idea that the reading gets the old value and the writing produces simply a new value which is only available afterwards. So that would be something. Another thing is that if you read and you, another option which perhaps also might be plausible is if you read and write in the same long instruction, that you kind of delay that instruction which reads so long as you always read the new value. That would be possible. Or you could delay the write for one instruction, so for one tick, so that the old value can be safely read. So these kind of different strategies which might make sense or might be provided by the hardware. And then there's the other thing, what happens if you have two writes to the same register? One could say that is completely stupid, but one could also say simply forbidden. So that would be the most easiest way, or that the leftmost right, the rightmost right wins, or something like that. In general, if the compiler creates such a long instruction word, the simultaneous writes could be perhaps avoided. It's a different story if you write to memory, but you cannot write to the same address twice in the same instruction if you kind of allow only one memory write per instruction. Otherwise, one would have their problem also. So in our examples, now we kind of, since there are multiple choices, we have to decide for something, and we would kind of decide for that simultaneous reads is permitted. Simultaneous writes, read, write, and write, write are ruled out, but only in that sense. So if there is such a thing, then we assume that it is not at the exactly at the same time, and one is if one is a tick later, then that is again fine. So like writing, reading from memory and writing to a register, which is read at the same in the same instruction, is possible if that reading is in the tick before, finished in the tick before, like here. So that is in this tick here, you kind of read, and only in that tick you write. So in that sense, this would be fine. Okay. Now we have certain rules, and now we might want to see, do we find methods to provide long instruction words for programs? So now programs are complicated, so we go, we try to cover larger and larger subparts of programs. So let us start with basic blocks. And then, now what are basic blocks? So basic blocks, these are just sequences of assignments. No branching, no jumps, nothing. So just basic blocks. Now, here is an example of such a basic block. And now we want to organize it in such a way that we kind of exploit maximal the parallelism of the hardware, and so perhaps overlapping even perhaps the execution of instructions. So what can we do? So we kind of in order to do that, we have to take care of all the dependencies which are inside, which kind of prohibit that two things are scheduled at the same time. So these are, so that for that we kind of could construct a data dependence graph. So then the vertices of this graph are the instructions, and the edges are the dependencies. So what kind of dependencies are there? So clearly, if you have a definition of a variable, then and the use of the same of this particular definition, then there should be a dependence between these. And if you have a use of one, if you have one definition and another definition, then you should keep the ordering, because otherwise, so if X is set to 1 and later it is set to 2, then you should better not exchange them, because otherwise later users will see the 1 instead of the 2. So that is, multiple definitions make cause a problem, and even the uses and definitions. So if you have multiple definitions, you could have use of one definition and use of another definition, and you should kind of not confuse these. So, and here you see already that a problem arises in case the same variable is defined multiple times. So for this kind of dependence analysis, it is very convenient to have a program in single assignment form, because then you simply could say these two kind of things will not arrive, occur. Yeah. So here in this particular stupid example, we would have this T, which is defined multiple times. And here the X is also defined multiple times, because there's an X from before the basic block, and then there is the X inside. So, but that is perhaps not so important, but at least this T, there should be a T1 and a T2, and that would be kind of be better. So, and then this, so here you see the relations between these different the different statements in this basic block. So clearly, so here this one corresponds to the values of variables, or the state, the program state before the entering the basic block. So, and that provides provides values for all the variables, and so that means it provides definitions for all the variables. So accordingly, it provides definitions for X and for A and for Z, but also for Y and T. So there are all these DD, these definition edges there. Assuming that all the variables are new, then at least one would have a definition, then this X would be defined, so that would be a DU edge. There would also be DU edges in this from this start point to all these initial to all these first. You could think of that as kind of the first layer of instructions. And then these have the X defined here is kind of is used here, and the T here, okay, that T set, so here this is a set 1, which is, so that is also kind of, so here it should be a T1, here a T2, so if one has made it a set 1, then this one, this edge goes away, and if one had this set here, so that one, this one, so here one would also have a set 1, then this one would also go away, because here this T would be a T2. and here one would have a T1. So that would be kind of, in that you see the graph becomes much less dense if you have this program in SSA form. And here you see already that if you do this instruction, scheduling of instructions, then it is wise if you have not yet done the register allocation, because by register allocation you put several variables into the same register, and that means that you introduce exactly what we see here in this basic block. You introduce definition, and use definition conflicts, which otherwise are not there if you did the register allocation later. So that means register allocation in that sense is in conflict, if you like, to instruction scheduling. And you better, either you do both at the same time, or you kind of do first the scheduling and then the register allocation. Okay. Now, so assuming that either we have this in what way soever, we have kind of put up these graphs which show the dependencies between the instructions, or the so which instructions have to be computed earlier and which have to be computed later. Now then, so this kind of thing we could in principle now schedule. The next, But we also have to take into account then the execution time of every instruction. As for every instruction, we know there are certain operations in it. We know how long it takes to compute the result. So, as in this little example, if we put into the same long instruction word a floating point multiplication and a memory load, then the maximal time is 3. And in fact, so if we have annotated each individual instruction with its individual execution time and perhaps also with the resources it occupies, then now our goal is to construct maximally parallel sequences of words which kind of execute correctly. So execute correctly means that is if I execute it, the value, every execution is possible, so there's nothing, no violation of constraints. And also the values which are returned are the same as the values which would have been returned in the end by the sequential sequence. So, and in how can we do that? Well, at least a way to describe the problem is to maintain for every time slot, for every tick, the values of the variables and maintain the system state in that sense, as we say, if we tell for every variable how long it will take until its current value is available. So initially, we assume that all the variables have their values. Now, as soon as we now start executing one long instruction word, then it will take some time. So that is until the variables will receive their final values. And as an invariant, then now, so this kind of then at the so. So we could, now the question is, if we have a basic block and we want to start to track for each and assume that we have already the long instruction words, then we might want to check how the state, this kind of system state changes. And so we have to know what is the system state at the start of the basic block. We assume that all variables there have their values. But that this seems innocent, but this means, since the basic block can be reached, the entry point of the basic block can be reached from many program points, that you have to make sure that whenever you arrive there, that this invariant holds. This is kind of an invariant which the compiler has to guarantee so that everything works correctly. Okay, so now how can we do it? Well, in general, to find a minimal sequence of long instruction words is a general scheduling problem, and that can be arbitrarily hard. Not arbitrarily hard, but at least NP hard, because there are only, I would say, there are only exponentially many possible schedules, and you kind of guess the right one and check that, and then if you are lucky, this is the optimal one. So in that sense, the optimal sequence is to find the optimal sequence. Sequence might be difficult, but on the but as usual, we are not interested in optimal sequences. We are only interested in good, sufficiently good sequences, and so we kind of could simply apply a greedy approach for constructing these words. And the greedy approach just then takes our data dependence graph and then takes the minimal elements in that graph. It's an acyclic graph. You take minimal elements and take the first ones or a suitable selection from the first ones and fill the slots of the first word. Then you remove these things from the graph. You kind of compute how the system state is, and then you determine. Then you try to fill the next word and so on. So here, let's see how that would work. So now I make the life a little bit simpler. I do not take long instruction words, but only short ones, namely those where we have two slots. So, and we have four variables which are of interest. These are x, y, z, and t. In this little example, this little basic block, so initially we have that all x, y, z, and t have all their values. So that is zero time slots to until they have their values. Zero ticks until they have their values. So now we take the minimal elements. Let us please quickly go back. Here is this graph. So we could take minimal elements. For example, we could take this one. And what is this, the other one which I chose? Yeah. So I did it simply from left to right. I take these two. This gives me this sequence. Now, for each of them, I can then determine for the in the next tick what will be the case. So when will be the, how long will it take after one more tick? So then in the next tick, I can schedule the next word. In the next tick, how long, then the value of x will be there, because integer addition takes one tick, but the value of y will not yet be there. It will take another tick until y will be available. And z and t have their values. Zero ticks have to be waited for until their value arrives. So that is now the new state. And within that state, I then have to check what kind of x other instruction can I do. Well, if I want to schedule this instruction in the next word, I must be sure that set is available. This is the case, so I can schedule it. And I must be sure that X and A are available in order to compute this one. And indeed, this is the case. So therefore, I can schedule these two things. And now I again see there's another memory read. Set will arrive only after one more tick. So that means in the next instruction, I cannot be schedule an instruction which accesses set. But I have to wait for one more instruction before I can schedule this t equals y plus set. So therefore, I have this kind of schedule where I was forced to fill in a knob instruction in between. And that is, these kind of things might happen, and that means that here it is a little bit sad. In each cycle, one might trigger such a concurrent, the execution of such a word, but not every in every cycle we succeed with that, and there might be also spare slots which could not be filled. Here in this case, it's not so surprising. If I have an odd number instructions to schedule and an even number of slots, then some slot will be empty. Yeah. So that, but you see here the numbers which occur here are always smaller or equal to the number how long it takes an instruction to be executed. So in this sense, the state is always finite. And if I had, now here I spoke about variables, but if there would be other resources which are occupied and which have to be taken into, which can only be used once and not multiple times, then I would kind of have, would be able, would kind of list them there and could also assign them times how long it they still will be occupied. Yeah. So in that sense, I get at least a succinct description of what I have to take care of when I do the scheduling. Okay. So could one, could you see at least how one in that sense, and then you construct the schedule, and this state tells you that everything is fine and that it is correct. Yeah. Okay. So the message which I want to transport here is that these system descriptions are finite. The system state descriptions are finite, and in that sense, what we and we have kind of state transitions, if you like, and so the computation of the effect of a selection which you have on the system state is something like a finite automaton. It's not so clear whether that helps us, but at least it's an interesting idea. And clearly, the number of system states, even if it's if they are finite, is huge. Think of you have 32 registers and 32 registers and delays of, say, to make things simple, between 0 and 3, and now you have then 4 to the power of 32, and this is a huge number. This would be the set of all system states which could arrive. So this is, you would not like to spell out that automaton in all detail. So still, and even if the automaton kind of describes all possible choices, we must make concrete choices, and that is not simplified by this encoding by a finite automaton. So that is the first thing. So, but I guess this greedy method is not so bad after all. But it will help us not. It will not save our necks, because altogether basic blocks typically are not so large. So you do a little bit of calculation, yes, but then it comes. You have a loop, and then you have a branching, and doing something without branching, conditional branching, then that is kind of quite blind processing, and that you can't do forever. So therefore, the opportunities of parallelizing simply basic blocks is not overwhelming. So we might want to extend that to more sophisticated pieces of code, for example, to acyclic code. So here's an example of acyclic code. What can we do there? Now, this data dependence is not sufficient. You also need kind of control dependence, so that you kind of execute something only after you know that this is executed. So here is, so you would also have an edge from dominating conditions to statements. So that means the condition, there is an edge, such an edge from here to all the statements which are dominated by that. And here we find, for example, in that particular case, this statement is executed no matter what value of x, whether x is greater than 1 or not greater than 1. So in that sense, this is we can put it out. But but the other parts of the things, so this statement here is only executed. This statement here is only executed when the condition is true. This is only executed when the condition is false. And this one here is executed only when both have both, yeah, one of them, it's not so clear which one, this depends on the runtime value of X, but when these you can schedule that only out behind the definitions of the Y. So that once again we have to add these control dependencies in order to capture all dependencies which are between the instructions of our code. Now and then in that sense, now with this extended, it's still a DAG what we have, and now we can kind of try to fill the slots of our instruction words with the notes from that DAG. So we could, for example, here. We could do it in such a way. For example, this set is kind of this assignment. The computation of the set is done first. It's independent of everything else, so we can do it right away. And then we have this. Additionally, we might schedule the branching. And now you see we can only add one such thing, and there could be a jump in it. So that means either if the condition is true, we will continue with A, or we continue right away. So if X is greater than 0, if this is not the case, so that is if X is less or equal to 0, then we continue simply with the next instruction, and we can do that without any delay, because here we do not access it's just a memory read, and we do not refer we do not access data which are not yet provided. And now afterwards, now one might want to know what we can do otherwise. Why can't I put the B here? So that's the next question. So this go to B. Why can't I put it here into this slot? Because B, that is, I jump somewhere, so there starts a basic block, and there I must guarantee the invariant that all the variables have received their values. But that's not the case for Y, because Y takes one more slot, one more tick to reach its value, because Y is computed by a memory read. So this takes two. So in the next slot, I cannot schedule the instruction at label B. So therefore, I could either do I can only make this go to B only if at the end of this go to B really the value Y or all other registers have received their values. So therefore, I must put the go to B into a separate instruction, which is a kind of annoying nuisance, because that means that I cannot use this one and I cannot use that one, and I have essentially put virtually everything into a separate word. So I have wasted a lot of slots. So now let's see what happens at label A. At label A, there is this other memory read, this one here. And again, the Y will receive its value only after one more tick. So that means the first instruction after the if then else, which is this one, cannot immediately follow the instruction at label A, but only the instruction afterwards. So I have to place here another stupid empty empty slot, namely a knob operation. So, and you see here, I have virtually everywhere these knob operations, these empty slots. And overall, it's even, I could have done everything sequentially, it would not have been slower. So you see, this is a stupid example because it's extremely small, and you might say, it's contrived, and in practice it will not happen. But I guess it will happen, and it shows that it's not so easy to get good schedules which really make good use of all the slots. Now, in this particular case, we could say that if we know all the states which arrive at a label, so here at this label B, so if I kind of put now deliberately, I put the go to B into the same instruction word, long instruction word as the writing to the Y, then I only have to keep in mind that I will arrive at B not with this 000 state, but with a state where there is Y takes one more tick. So then I could say, okay, the same holds true when I come from that direction, and that only means that when at label B, I have to wait one more tick before I can continue. So that is better in that sense that I have kind of filled one more slot, but still I have here these empty things and here these empty things. So, but it's a little bit better. Yeah. So that would be kind of the next method. The next method of choice. The other idea is that we might kind of introduce a speculative computation. So if you have an empty slot, we could kind of do something in there, and if the worst thing what happens is that we did something useless. But if it might be still in some situation, it might be beneficial. The only thing is, when we do such speculative filling of slots, that we kind of that this speculation should not result in catastrophes. So how can it result in catastrophe? So if you speculate on y divided by x, and x might have the value 0, then this might trigger a runtime error. And this would not be there if there would be there no speculation. So you have to kind of either you have to you can do a speculative you can speculate a computation only if you are sure that it will not result in a catastrophe like a division by zero or a memory out of bounds access or a illegal memory access or things like that. Either you do that, or you kind of the hardware provides you with the facility to commit the effects of a computation later, so that you kind of say, okay, now later I find yes, the computation I did was useful, and then I commit it, and then all the effects, bad effects, good effects, take place. So if you have such a commit thing, then if you have hardware support for that, then you can more aggressively make use of such speculation. Otherwise, you must be able to roll back somehow. So now let's see here in this particular example. Now I extended the width of my instruction words to 3, and here you see I kind of speculated. X is greater than 0. I speculated that, and that means in this case is then this the right instruction. Otherwise, I would have to do this instruction. So I speculate to do that. Now, if it's wrong, if it's correct, then I'm done, and then I can continue afterwards. Otherwise, I have to, the value which I put into Y is the wrong one, but that I, then I can kind of trigger the right computation, and this will override the old value of Y. So in that sense, this value of Y will be lost, but it was wrong anyway, and I take this value of Y, and that's the right one. So in that sense, this is good, because I do not roll back, but the speculation simply is I override the value of the speculation, and in that sense there is no bad effect. The only problem might be that this here is an illegal access to illegal memory access, and this might be a legal memory access, and in that sense if there is a hardware exception in case of an illegal memory access, then this would not be a correct code. Yeah. So that the effect of Y would have the right value if that value is defined, but if it's an illegal access and so you never reach the second point, then you cannot do it like that, at least. Or you can do it only if you kind of avoid to commit this instruction, and then simply trigger the next one. Okay? So, and that, in this sense, in both cases, at label B, when we arrive at label B, we arrive there from two control flow points, two points in the program, and in both cases one has to wait for one more tick until the value of Y is there. So therefore, we still have this empty instruction here. Okay, so that would be kind of what one would do in this particular situation. How well that works is one might wonder. And there's also the situation. The question is should we speculate on that value or on that value? So that is it is not clear which of, so how would, if we introduce speculation at a conditional branching, it's the compiler, how can the compiler know which of the branches is taken more frequently? So you can either do it by profiling or you do it somehow. For conditional branching, if then else, there's no clear idea what which one will be executed more frequently. One might think that you could kind of look at the code in the then part and in the else part, and if in that part, which is where the code is heavier somehow, whatever that means, is more complicated, then you would think that this is better to speculate on. Either this is taken more often, or it is, then it's okay. And otherwise, if it's not taken more often, then at least when it is taken, you have kind of already made progress a little bit in that direction. So you kind of lowered the cost of executing that. So in this sense, speculation on the more complicated part of if then else is perhaps the desirable thing. So now the question is, now what happens if we have if then else is still not so, gives, may not or may not necessarily improve on our strategy for basic blocks alone. The more it might be the real hard work is in loops. So the question is, how do we deal with loops? And now here one idea would be simply, well, if we have loops which we want to optimize, and then kind of doing the doing the paralyzation, so to speak, only here inside might not be so, does not bring us very far. But then what we could do is kind of to increase the size of the loop body. And that we could do simply by unrolling the loop, but not unrolling it in such a way that we unroll it in the front, but we unroll the body. So that is, there's still a loop, but the loop body now has the double length. And the only thing is what we have to be careful with, that now if we kind of by that duplicate the loop body, we must be, there is the possibility that there's an excess, an exit of the loop in between the two, in the middle of the loop. But if you have that, now it's clear how the speculation should go, because here the loop is this one, and we assume that this computation must be optimized. So if we have now to deal with that kind of if then else, and we want to do speculation, then we would speculate for staying inside the loop. That is, we would speculate here for the instructions in that block, and here at that for the conditional branching at the beginning of the loop, we also would speculate for the entering the loop and not for leaving the loop, and would jump outside the loop only when necessary. Okay, so that's kind of the idea how to deal with larger things like loops. There must only be must be careful and one could kind of take into account the different instances of the body are translated now relative to different possible entry states, because now I know for the think of the body is replicated three times, then the first body is the first copy of the body receives entry states from outside the loop and from the jumping, from the back jump. The next copy of the body will only be receives entry states only from the last iteration, and so on. So we could kind of therefore have different schedules for the different copies of the body. And then the that is one thing, and the other thing which we have to take care of is, maybe I make it in green, that when we have the code behind the loop, then we have the code behind the loop could be accessed not only via that edge, but also via that edge, and so we have to take the states arriving from here and the states arriving from there into account in order to determine and make sure that the schedule of the next basic block there is safe with respect to all these states. Now let's make an example and see how our ideas work. So here is a very stupid, again, but these most stupid examples exhibit already interesting features, which and shows that naive approaches may easily fail. So here is a not completely, almost completely stupid, but still interesting piece of code. So it's a for loop, very simple, x is increased, and we write to memory you could think of it as initializing an array. So that's what's going on, and the start address of the array is A. That is what we do. And now here is the control flow graph, and we see here the body, the basic block constituting the body of that loop consists of These two assign the writing to memory followed by an increment of x. That's it. There's nothing more. And so you see, there's little opportunity for parallelism. Why? Because here I use the old value of x, and here I increase the x. So there's no, I cannot do it at the same time. Oh well, I could do it at the same time, but that's perhaps if the semantics of the hardware is good enough, then I could do it even at the same time. So that's all. And now I try to unroll it to get perhaps more opportunities for parallelization. And now you see here what happens. So here is a definition of x. Here is this x is queried is a use of x, so I cannot exchange these. And then here is again a use of x, and here is a new definition. So in some sense, there is no the opportunity for parallelization has somehow not increased. And so, but what can one do here? Well, here is the point is here in this for loop that you always you have this x here which is incremented and which is tested, and that gives a kind of makes it sequential. So there is no so it's not so that the two bodies of the two copies of the body kind of form together, if you like, a longer basic block which can be scheduled. No, there's in between. There is this very sequential situation. You have the update to the x before, and you query the x immediately at the condition. And so there's no moving around. So nothing from the second copy can be shifted into the first in parallel to instructions from the first copy. So it's simply so. We have gained virtually nothing. So, but what we could do now? What can we do here in this particular situation? In this particular situation, it would be better if we kind of remove in some way this increment of x in the middle, and if we could remove that and kind of we remove that and also the test, and then we get a larger basic block. So how can we do that? Well, we kind of have to check we kind of have to detect already here whether we will iterate two times and not just one time. So what is under which, let us go back, under which situations do we know here that we will go here and there? So that is the case if x is if this is the case if this condition is true, if x is less than n and x plus 1 is less than n. Now, if x is less than n and x plus 1 is less than n, that's the same as x plus 1 is less than n. Yeah. So, therefore, if we check here if x plus 1 is less than n, then we do the two iterations in sequence. And if this is not the case, then we check whether at least x is less than n. And if that is the case, we execute once more. This is kind of the last iteration. And if this is not the case, then we do nothing anymore. So you see here, now we have kind of improved this program significantly by kind of moving this kind of branching out of the loop after the loop. We have postponed it, and that is beneficial in many ways. In particular, this test is kind of which is in always in this inner loop. It has been moved out of the inner loop and follows the loop. So in that sense, the code now has become much more efficient in that sense, and the body has kind of the composed body consists of a basic block which is larger. Now here in this particular case, this larger basic block contains two memory operation writes, which perhaps cannot be scheduled put into the same instruction, but under other conditions, either if you are allowed to do several memory writes or if there are other instructions, other operations also going on in the body of the loop, then you might gain something, because now you have here a contiguous basic block as a loop body which offers all kinds of optimizations. And in particular, what you also see inside the loop, you do no longer have a single two increments, but only one increment. So you save this update, the branching, and you save the recomputation, one recomputation of the X. Yeah? So that would be the transformation which one might have in mind here. Yeah? So, yeah, and here in this particular case, we find that the two loop iterations are, in fact, the operations there. There are these two assignments, they go to different places. So the two iterations now really are independent in this case, as the writes go to different places, to different entries in the array, if you like. Although, in that particular example, we are not lucky. We are not able to exploit it, since we have only one store per word. Yeah, but in case we would have more operations inside our basic blocks, we would kind of then freely could combine them with any of these memory writes. Okay, so that means we have now to this massaging of loops, this loop unrolling, if you like, or extending of loop bodies, is not as trivial as we might have thought of, because it all boils, so it is essential to try to remove the internal, the intermediate branchings. But one can do more things if one takes now, it takes a closer look to all kinds of loops which are provided in your code. For example, if you have several loops, here for example the left one and the right one, these two loops, you might think of trying to combine them into one. And by that you obtain a single loop which has a larger loop body and thus offers more opportunities to optimization. Now the question is, are we allowed to join these two loops into one? Now, here in this particular case, there is the same arrays are read, but different arrays are written to. And so, in that sense, these two loops are completely independent. So, here so there's a little bit of a catch here in that here this it is the same R which is used here and there, and the same S which is used here and there. And so, but it is, the definitions for these are the same. So in that sense, it is, it could be possible to merge these two loops into one, But one must be careful because in between, if you think of that this the one loop is executed after the other loop, then it follows that the body has been executed not for here for x equals 0, but for many x's until x equals n minus 1. And the second one is, so if you arrive at for the same x, then there are some, the same body has been evaluated for the smaller x's of the second iteration and for the larger x's in the first iteration. And these extra executions of copies of the body must not kind of interfere, so the ordering somehow in which the bodies are evaluated for various axes changes if I kind of fuse these kind of loops into one. So therefore extra thinking or extra calculations must be performed in order to decide whether such kind of loops can be merged and fused into a single loop. But that kind of techniques we will look at tomorrow. So thank you for today, and we meet again tomorrow very early.